Okay, so I'm going to talk about fear. And I think it's obvious that fear is a big part of many of our lives. A lot of people who do mindfulness practice, which is a practice of just learning to pay attention a little bit to what's going on around us and in us, a little bit more than we usually are. Many people who do that are often surprised to find that fear is actually a much bigger part of their inner ecology, their psychological ecology, than they realized. And you often realize also that there's levels of fear. There's this kind of great, obvious, overt fears, you know, when you're afraid of, death is a good one, right? Or you're afraid of the car, which is, you know, racing down the road at you at 60 miles an hour, and you're afraid of what people are going to think about you, and you're afraid of what your boss is going to think of you, and you're afraid of rejection, and you're afraid of many things we're afraid of. And it can get very, very subtle. And as a spiritual practice, as a mindfulness practice, gets more subtle, and as we become more intimately aware of the details of our psychology, it's often very, very subtle levels of fear, which are often the sometimes the most powerful ones that are influencing our lives. Anyway, we become aware of these fears. And part of what we do in mindfulness practice is we become students of fear. We become students of all our emotions, all our feelings, student of our whole inner life and outer life. But fear is just one area where we can kind of give some attention for these few Thursdays here. And I think it's important in looking at an emotion or a feeling, a response like fear, it's important to remember that the practice of mindfulness is a practice of bringing respect to our inner life. And it's kind of cute, the word respect, because respect literally means to see, to look again, to see again. And so to look more carefully, to be more mindful, is our task. But respect also in the sense that in mindfulness practice, we don't want to be involved with condemning or criticizing or even judging any of our inner emotional responses. Many of us growing up, and for whatever reason, have gotten the message that certain kinds of feelings and emotions are good and some are bad, and the bad ones should be suppressed or they should be justified, and or they, you know, a lot of things, we have a lot of attitude towards them. I'm bad or I'm wrong because I have these kinds of emotions. And in mindfulness practice, we want to see if we can drop all those kinds of judgments and valuations of the good and badness of emotions, but rather respect them in a sense of looking more carefully and really getting to understand them, be a student of them, and find out what's there. Fear is, can be a difficult emotion to explore because fear usually entails not wanting to pay attention to something, not wanting something to happen. Something feels like a threat. And kind of the natural response to something which is a threat is to want to pull away from it. But for many of us, I think for most of us, the kind of fears that come up in our normal life are not imminent dangers. It isn't like that the mountain lion's about to pounce. You know, or it's not about that you're kind of going to step over the edge of some, you know, 90-foot cliff, or it's not about that you're going to, you know, you're stepping into traffic that's going 60 miles an hour. Many of the fears that we have are much more kind of subtle. They're not about obvious threats. And when they're not about obvious threats, one of the best things we can do is to use our mindfulness practice, use our ability to pay attention, to bring our attention to what's going on, to pay attention to the fear, to pay attention to the threat. But as I said, it can be difficult to do that because I think there's often a tendency, well, I don't want to. You know, the fear is a kind of almost an effort to protect ourselves. And so you kind of have to almost go against the kind of almost natural kind of form of protection in order to find out, is this really realistic? Is there a real threat here? What's really going on? But we want to study it with respect. And that means also when fear is really strong, knowing how to give it lots of space. You don't have to rush into it and try to, be stoic about facing your fears and dealing with your fears. Sometimes the best thing to do is to kind of figure out, how can I make myself more safe? What can I do that can bring some kind of safety or security for me that's realistic. And then from that place of security, then maybe kind of look over the edges into the fear and kind of approach it, rather than looking at it in the midst of it when we're in the fire, if it's possible. But there are three insights, or three ways in which mindfulness practice helps us understand our life, which is very helpful with working with fear. The first one is that when there's something unpleasant in our experience, for example, pain, or something unpleasant experience, an unpleasant experience or pain does not equal that we're bad, or the experience is bad, or that something is wrong necessarily. If we sit here and we have a bad meditation, you know, things, you know, it's not particularly pleasant, you're sitting here and things aren't particularly pleasant in your meditation, it's easy enough to decide something's wrong. It's maybe something's wrong with me. I'm not succeeding in meditation. There, you know, I'm responsible, I'm to blame, something has gone terribly wrong here. Pleasantness or unpleasantness of our experience as we sit here is just part of the flow of change, the flow of what happens, rises and passes in our experiences. Some unpleasant and some pleasant things happen to us, and we can learn to kind of adjust them and change them. But a lot of things that happen to us don't necessarily mean that something is bad or that we're wrong. And you find in American culture a tremendous aversion towards unpleasantness, to discomfort. There's a feeling almost as if discomfort is wrong, it's bad, you don't deserve it, it shouldn't happen, something's wrong with me if it happens. And so we spend a lot of time trying to do whatever we can to avoid discomfort and uncomfortable situations. And sometimes it's appropriate to do that, and sometimes we end up just numbing ourselves. In the process of numbing ourselves, we really numb ourselves to our capacity to feel our life and feel our friends and our community in a deep way. And we know many of the ways in which people do that, you know. Alcohol and drugs and workaholics are many times our ways of kind of avoiding our fears, avoiding our pains, avoiding kind of inner discomfort many of us have. When we sit in meditation and our knee hurts, it might be hurting because the muscles are kind of tight in the thighs. And if you're not used to sitting this way, they start beginning to stretch. And stretching hurts. And it doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that the experience is wrong or terrible or to be judged. It just means that your legs, your muscles maybe are stretching a little bit. And what we learn, I think, one of the things we learn in meditation is to take that kind of discomfort and learn to be comfortable with it being there. Oh, it's just discomfort. It's just a kind of uncomfortable sensation here. I don't have to try to change it or manipulate it. I don't have to come to any conclusions about the meditation. I can just allow the discomfort to be there and find my peace, find my equanimity, find my well-being, even with it present. And that's a very radical thing to discover, that you can have a kind of well-being, a kind of sense of peace with oneself or peace with your life that's not dependent on getting rid of all the discomforts that might arise in your experience. And if you can learn to do that with small things in your meditation practice, then that begins to, you can be able to translate that into your normal life, in daily life. Things happen that make you uncomfortable, that are uncomfortable. And maybe you can be comfortable with being uncomfortable. It's okay to be uncomfortable. Rather than thinking, oh, something's wrong, I have to do something immediately, take care of it, or fix it, or change it, or attack it, or whatever. So this insight can be very useful for fear, because fear is an uncomfortable feeling to have. I think it's inherently uncomfortable. Sometimes people react not against the fear, but they're reacting against the aversion to being uncomfortable. But as we learn to be comfortable with discomfort, I think we also can learn to be a little more comfortable with fear as it arises. That's one of the first insights that comes with practice, that can come with practice, and that is that discomfort or pain doesn't need to have a judgment that you're wrong or the situation is wrong or bad. The second insight is that the thoughts that you have, the particular thoughts, the ideas that kind of whirl around your head, they are not necessarily the truth. And that can be very liberating, to realize we don't have to believe our thoughts. Our mind has this tremendous ability to churn out a tremendously creative amount of wisdom and garbage. And is it an equal dosage? And it's amazing, you know, what goes on in my mind and this kind of thoughts and ideas I have. And one of the things I've learned as I've, you know, gone through life is that how I understand or interpret a situation, interpret myself, isn't necessarily what's really going on. And so I've learned to have kind of not to take things, so my interpretations of events for granted, or take the interpretations as being representing the truth. And what I'm learning to do, what we're learning to do in mindfulness practice, is to distinguish between our interpretations of events, the stories we say about them, versus what actually might be going on there. And sometimes it's not completely clear, but you say, well, it's not so clear, but this is my interpretation. People who have never taken some moments, taken some time to become reflective about the nature of their thoughts will often end up believing, in a sense, all their thoughts and just kind of running around, being chased by them or being kind of propelled by them as if they know what's best or they know what's really going on. So one of the insights that comes with mindfulness practice is that our thoughts aren't necessarily the truth. They sometimes are just stories or just interpretations of what's going on. So that's very helpful with fear also, because fear, when it's when it's not immediate, when it's not the mountain lions about to jump on you, when it's unlocalized, when it's vague, it often involves a level of storytelling, story making. We're telling ourselves stories. When I go to work tomorrow, and I have to make my presentation, you know, maybe I'm going to forget my notes at home, and I have to go up there and speak without my notes, and won't that be terrible, and I'll be embarrassed, and this is, you know, and then all this fear arises, I'm really worried, what's going to happen? But you haven't left home yet, and you know you have the notes in your briefcase, and, you know we make a story about what might happen, and the fear has more to do with what that story than any, you know, than anything else. And a lot of times the unspecific fears that we arise have to do with what we call kind of what-if story making. They have to do with stories we tell ourselves. So one of the ways to investigate fears, chronic fears, is to try to become sensitive to what are the stories that we tell ourselves. What is the, that we kind of take for granted. We don't even see that the story is there, but we've kind of told ourselves a very subtle story. The further away in time the object of fear is, the more likely it is that you're involved in storytelling about the event. And I've learned, you know, after many, you know, painful experiences, that not to worry so much about what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day or in a week or in a month, because so much can happen between now and then. I've spent so much time in my life, you know, worrying about things that never end up happening. Do you know that one? You know, after a while, I said, well, gee, you know, what a waste of time. Because, you know, it's one thing to worry about things that are going to happen, but to spend all this time kind of worrying about things which never do happen. Anyway, the point is, the insight that's useful is that we don't necessarily have to believe our thoughts. That the thoughts are often in the form of storytelling, and the storytelling may or may not be accurate. And with fear, especially, it has more to do with interpretations than often what's really true. The third thing, insight about fear, about it, or insight that comes with mindfulness practice, has to do with this learning to respect our emotions, respect our inner life. That whatever arises in our inner life, whatever feelings, emotions, even thoughts, whatever arises is in a sense there for a reason. And I kind of like to see things, and what has arisen, what's occurred. What you can become mindful of is only what has arisen, what's kind of occurred. If something has occurred, I think it's often best to take it as a symptom. or take it as a given. This is a given. This is what arose, and maybe it's a symptom. And what are the causes and conditions that allowed this to happen, that stimulated this? And with feelings like fear, I think it's best to take the attitude that it's there for a reason. And it's an attempt, it's an indication that something is wrong. Sometimes an indication, you know, the mountain lion's out there and you better do something. Sometimes an indication that maybe there's a real thing to be concerned about. There can be very real fears about what's going to happen tomorrow. And you need to kind of prepare ourselves. But even when we find that the fear we have has more to do with vague interpretations, vague anxiety, about something completely unspecific about what might happen, that it's still an indication that something, this is not judging, that something needs our attention, that there's something there that wants our attention. And so we take the fear as our friend, pointing, saying, oh, here's my fear. I'm not going to judge this fear or this anxiety or this worrying as being bad. Rather, I'm going to take this fear as an indication that there's something here that I need to look at more carefully. And what is that? So you notice that if you go into a room of new people, every time you walk in, there's a lot of anxiety, which is kind of a fear. Okay, this fear is wanting to tell me something. I need to pay attention to this. I'm not going to kind of bulldoze over it and say, well, there's no reason to be afraid, and there's no reason to be anxious. What's really going on here? What you might find, what some people might find, is that underneath that fear, in the anxiety, is a very specific fear, perhaps the fear of rejection, fear of what people are going to think of me. And then we study that. What is that about? What is the fear of rejection about? And we might find as we study it, as we feel and sense it, that there's a kind of layer of insecurity in our psyche, in our personality. That's very valuable to discover and to find. And then to start hanging out and exploring, getting to know that level of insecurity, to see if we can find in the midst of it or deeper in it a new kind of sense of security, new kind of well-being, a sense of trust. That could be much more valuable than talking to ourselves, you know, kind of convincing ourselves through our thoughts, oh, there's nothing to worry about in this situation, all these people are my friends, and, you know, I should kind of take a stoic kind of stance and just go in there and with courage and not worry about what people think about me. That's kind of glossing over what's really maybe going on. But rather to study it, to take fear as a request from within you. Here is something I need to study. Here is something I need to find out what's going on. And if we do that, I think that we can follow the tracks of our inner life back to a place where we begin becoming realistically trusting, realistically more at ease and secure in our life. Someone came to me recently and asked me how she could become more trusting. And so I said, well, why do you want that? And she said, well, I worry a lot, and I'm very afraid of, you know, what might happen in my life and all these different things. I spend a lot of time planning what might go wrong, worried about what might go wrong. I mean, I spent 75% of my time, she said, planning what might go wrong, being worried about what might go wrong. And more often than not, it has nothing to do with what's really going on in reality, what's really going to happen. How can I be more trusting? And I didn't give her an answer directly, but what I said was, what I asked her was, what function, what is the worrying do for you? When you spend a lot of time worrying and planning and trying to arranging the things in the future, kind of setting everything up in your mind to take care of them, what is it doing for you? What are you trying to do? And she kind of thought for a while, and she said, what did you say? She said, well, you know, I don't remember exactly what you said, but what you could have said is, you know, I'm trying to protect myself. You know, I'm trying to protect myself. So then I suggested to her, rather than trying to find more trust, when you find yourself planning and worrying a lot, why don't you look and see in that situation what you can do to feel more protected, and to take that on as an exercise for a while. So rather than to look for some inner quality of trust, to look at if the movement towards worrying, constant worrying, is a movement of trying to protect yourselves, maybe that desire for protection should be honored. And she should spend some time saying, well, what can I do to provide some kind of protection? And I don't mean that she should kind of, you know, go out and get a gun and get, you know, and lock all, you know, get extra locks on their doors and do all kinds of things. But rather just kind of in a very matter-of-fact way, kind of in the present moment, what would it take to feel more safe, to feel safer? Maybe it means being more honest with the people she is in contact with, telling them what's going on. Maybe it means being more honest with herself. Maybe it means not rushing into situations where she's unfamiliar, but rather realistically sitting down and actually planning this, you know, little bit, this is what I'm going to do. And having realistic plans sometimes can create a little more safety. But the reason I said all this to her was not so much to give her some kind of techniques, but rather to give her some indication that her fear and her worry, her anxiety, probably originates from some place that is a healthy desire, healthy movement. And one of the ways to work with something like fear is to trace back what's motivating it, to see if you can find what is most healthy in this motivation. So, if, you know, at the heart of being rejected, being fear of being rejected, is some kind of insecurity, the desire to be secure might be a healthy movement. The question then is, what is a realistic way of doing that, of finding security? And if we're looking for security outside of ourselves, maybe that's not really the healthiest way of finding it, because the external world is ultimately not a very secure place to rely on. But it's possible to find an inner security. So what I want is security. What does that mean? And what does it mean to find a secure refuge within myself? And so that becomes a spiritual question, a question to explore. What is a safe form of security? What is a realistic form of security? In the context of Buddhist practice, the greatest form of security we can provide ourselves with is our attention, is our ability to bring attention to what's going on. So as we begin finding what provides us with security, as we doing this mindfulness practice, what we'll tend to find is the mindfulness itself becomes our best friend. The mindfulness itself becomes our best form of security. And it's a marvelous thing, because probably nothing else can do it as well for us as our mindfulness. So we want to be very respectful of our fear, very gentle with it, very allowing of it. One of the ways to work with fear is to name it very clearly, to be very, very clear and honest. Oh, this is what's going on. I'm anxious. I'm worried. I'm afraid. I'm terrified. Just simply to name it. And then once we've named it, in order to kind of let it hover, to let it kind of stay there for a while so we can get to know it, it's very useful to drop down into our body and to feel the fear in the body. By feeling it in the body, we can often be with the fear, sensing it in a way that doesn't trip us off into our storytelling. And our storytelling is often where we tend to create more and more trouble for ourselves. So to be present for the fear, to explore it, it can be very useful to feel it, the tightness, the vibration, the energy, the pulsing that might be going on in the body somewhere. So I feel like I've talked enough. So what is your comments or questions? Or what is your ideas? Yes.
So if you go to the place where you do feel the feelings when you are feeling fearful, then you just sort of stay there and just feel what they are.
It's a wonderful thing to do. I mean, there's different levels, different areas that can be explored. And so in different times, you might want to explore different areas. But one of the ways, I mean, sometimes we want to just explore the storytelling. Actually get to know, you know, what are these stories I'm telling myself? Other times you want to get, you don't want to get involved in the story. You notice that whenever you do that, you get caught in the story too much. Another way of being present for fear is to actually feel the sensations in the body, like you said, and just to hang out with it. And it can be, a lot of trust can arise, can be cultivated, by learning that it's safe actually to sit here quietly and simply to feel and breathe with the fear and not having to do anything with it. So, as one of my friends who had it, he did a 3-month, I tell the story often, he did a 3-month course at Berry, the same time I did. And at some point in the middle of the 3-month course, he had a lot of fear. Came up, you know, a 3-month course. Nothing, I mean, talk about a safe place. A 3-month meditation retreat. You know, everything's taken care of. They cook for you. No one talks to you. Really, you're left completely alone. No one expects anything of you. There's completely one of the most safest places in the world. And he was terrorized. You know, all this terror came up, and he had a very hard time coping with it, until he realized that his fear manifested itself as a lot of tightness and vibration in his chest. I mean, he realized that that's how it manifested itself in his body. He also realized, oh, I can hang out with vibration and tightness in my chest. And he did that. He hung out with it. And that gave him the ability, it gave him kind of the toehold to be with his fear rather than always recoiling from it. So, you know, and that's often why fear is so strong fear is very difficult to recoil from it so strongly. So feeling it in the body can give us kind of an anchor to allow it to be there without being reactive to it.
Mm-hmm. So, I've been doing that because you know you've been giving these talks for quite a while.
And I say the same thing.
No,
I think so.
Because I'm figuring out what to do. So before my stomach didn't hurt, but now my stomach hurts quite a bit from time to time.
Uh-huh.
So, I imagine that eventually that changes, but I'm in the place where my stomach hurts.
It'll change, that's for sure.
Right.
Yes.
So I figure there are feelings that have been there, but I haven't been able to feel them for years.
That's quite likely. It's a quite common experience for people. Is as the surface, for others, as the surface kind of preoccupations, the surface protections and defenses we have, and the ways in which we defend ourselves with our body begin softening, some of the deeper kind of emotions which are held or repressed or frozen get a chance to thaw and kind of surface. And sometimes what we need to do in our practice is allow these things just bubble up and bubble up and bubble up, and just they can be quite powerful and overwhelming. And it can be very healthy just to allow the waterfall, you know, just this stuff just to come. And while it does that, it can be very uncomfortable. And so if we have the idea that discomfort is not where it's at, that something's wrong when we're uncomfortable, we might actually shut off the valve and not really allow that process to happen. It's interesting, I've read that chronically tense muscles go numb. And if that's the case, as we begin releasing that chronic tension, I think that it would be natural then to feel to go through a period of time where there's pain or discomfort there also. Yeah.
I've been dealing periodically over the last year with really deep despair, and in my practice here, I've become more accepting of just letting it be there when it is. But I guess maybe I expected that it would lessen at some point, or I would get beyond it. And I don't know. Am I wallowing in this and kind of clinging to it, or is it just still working itself out? And I'm kind of, I don't know where I'm at right now with it.
Those are good questions.
The only person who can answer them is me.
Probably, but I think but since you frame it those ways, you might kind of look at both those options and see what might be going on. And it could be, I mean, sometimes the inner processing takes a long time. And it's just a matter of getting out of the way and allowing it to come there. And don't have an interpretation of, you know, I shouldn't be this way. Other times, it might be serving some purpose. You know, you might be attached to it for some reason. And so, to my look, you know, what is this doing for me? What am I trying to do? Am I afraid to go into it, in the, you know, the depths of it? And so am I really holding myself back or kind of hovering, you know? Or is it, you know, in myself, you know, is it good for my self-identity to somehow be a despairing person? There's really, you know, what our mind does is really phenomenal. It's like the people who, there are some people who feel that they're only adequate as, for example, parents, if they're worrying. Because worrying is a sign that you care. And the only way they can kind of convince themselves and other people that they care, the only way they know is to worry. And, it's kind of a maladaptive way, perhaps, of trying to do something which is really maybe useful, and that is to show our caring. But maybe there's other ways, you know, other ways to learn to care besides worrying. So it's very interesting, the reason why we might sometimes hold on to painful emotional states, the third option is that it isn't so much that you need to keep processing it, and it isn't so much that you're holding on to it, but there might be that there's some aspect of it that you haven't really acknowledged yet, or haven't really accepted, and haven't really seen. So that's a matter of kind of maybe taking a wider perspective, or looking around more, perhaps talking with friends or talking with other people who might know about such things, and just seeing, well, this is what I've learned, this is what I'm exploring, and you know, you think, is anything I've left out, or any perspective you can give to me on this? Yes.
Can it also be habit, that, and other type of repetitive things? There is nothing causing it; you're just used to feeling that way.
I suspect so.
Certain things may trigger it, and that's just how you, until you recognize that, oh, this happens and I feel this way,
yeah,
maybe they just keep happening like that.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think we have habits of mind and habits of responding, which is pretty automatic. I think so. One of the descriptions of mindfulness practice is the practice of de-automatization. So we're turning off the automatic ways or the habitual ways in which the mind works. And it takes two things which are very helpful for that process. And one is seeing clearly, and the other is the degree in which we can get calm. The two of those things can be very helpful. The degree to which we can get calm. Both those things are very useful for helping us let go of habits. Yes?
I've been trying this, and what I have tried to use is something that you said. I'd like to comment on when we sit and whatnot, and something comes up, you have said, well, you made that the meditation. And it seems to me that you said that we can make that meditation in three ways. We can explore the thought patterns, we can explore the feelings, and we could, if it is sort of out of control, then we can force ourselves to go back to the breathing. Are there other ways to deal with something about making fear of meditation?
So the question is, other ways than...
And the three things that I mentioned.
Oh, I see.
Explore the thought patterns.
Uh-huh.
Where is this coming from?
Right.
What is it doing? You can explore the feelings that are associated with that. And then you said, then if it's just sort of rampant and whatnot, then we can force ourselves to put it out of our minds, force ourselves back.
For force is kind of a strong word, but if it's too difficult, or we feel like we're getting pulled into kind of whirlpool of kind of it's feeding itself and getting worse, finding some way to kind of step away from it is very useful. And there's many ways of doing that. Sometimes simply going back to the breath can be very useful. Just kind of neutral place for some people, and just kind of be with the breath and let the fears be in the background, kind of let it recede for a while. Other people might find that doing some loving kindness meditation is useful as a kind of antidote, or as a kind of refuge, or kind of a taking a break, a vacation. Maybe going for a walk or going for a run can be useful. You know, actually doing something can be helpful. And there's many as a whole. You know, once you start thinking about ways, you know, you can use your wisdom in many ways. You know, if you really feel sincerely it's getting to be too much, just, you know, a huge repertoire of things you can do. So the one is to do something that kind of takes you away from it and kind of helps you calm down. And then from that place, you can kind of decide to go back in, kind of, explore the edges. And then the two ways, which you mentioned also, one is to kind of understand what's going on with your mind, the cognitive part, and the other is to ignore the more emotional, the physical part, what's going on with the body. Because of the way we've been talking about it in terms of exploring, another option we have is not to do anything but allow it to be there. And sometimes that's the wisest. Because often when we start exploring, the motivation behind the exploration can be to try to change it or get rid of it. And really, there should be no attempt to try to make anything go away or improve anything. The exploration is simply for the sake of exploration. But with something like fear, we can be very much, I'm going to explore this, see if I can get rid of it, or see if I can blow it out of existence or whatever. The spirit should be one of allowing. And in the midst of allowing, we might explore it in various ways. And sometimes the allowing has very little exploration as part of it. Just, there's fear, I'm going to allow it to be there. I'm going to know that it's there. I'm going to breathe with it and breathe through it or whatever. But I'm not going to really going to try to, do anything, penetrate it or understand anything about it. Bonnie?
I had a wonderful example of fear on my way over here, which actually parallels the story that you told sometime. I had only allowed about 5 minutes to get here, so I was very intent on coming and probably going too fast. And someone was parked next to me as I was driving, and she came just tearing out in front of me. And I put my hand on the horn and left it there for a long time. I was startled by that, and anger arose. And I thought, I heard myself say, "What is this? What is this?" You know, looking at the anger. And just moments later, it was, "This is fear. This is an anger." I felt it in my body because we were almost in an accident. And then I thought of it going back to the anger, but then I said, no, this is fear. Not to talk myself into it, but fear really rose again. And then moments later, the fear started melting, and then compassion came up. And I remembered your story, not at that time, but I'm thinking about it now, and it had a life of its own. I felt compassion for the driver's fear, that this poor woman did. I was probably in her blind spot, and she didn't see me do it. Hmm. It's great to see that whole evolution in probably 30 or 40 seconds.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful to see that. And as we become more familiar with fear, what you'll start noticing is what Bonnie noticed, is that fear often generates a lot of secondary emotions. And anger is one of them. That sometimes anger is a result of fear. In a situation like that, in the first moment of anger, it's really a very strong, adamant, impassioned response to protect yourself and take care of the situation. But in other situations, there's no need to get angry, but the fear automatically goes into anger and people start lashing out. Really what they need to do is not simply understand their fear, they need to understand, not understand the anger, they need to understand the fear that's generating the anger.
I know an example of mine is about a week ago I found out that my company was moving up to San Francisco and I got very angry because it was not what I wanted to do and my personal life is down since when I lived down here. And just in this last week I realized that my anger was a lot of fear, and I guess I'm trying to just figure out how to cope with maybe afraid to think of the change is what it is. And not knowing what that's going to bring. But that's something sort of similar happened to me. I was very angry and almost like rebellious, like I used to be when I was a kid. And then I realized I was just scared.
Uh-huh. And if you acknowledge the fear, then I think you're probably in a more realistic place to take care of it. But if you're taking care of your anger, you're probably not really taking care of what needs to be taken care of.
Yeah.
You're probably making it worse. Yes.
Just recently, my friend and I high up on a grand cliff about 600 feet above the ground. I guess you were talking about fantasies. This reoccurring fantasy kept going in my head that I would slip and fall and plummet eventually to the ground and scare it up. But it almost seemed like that was healthy. And I was wondering, if, you know, even when you're that close, you know, it would almost seem like my fear would be debilitating, but I don't know, would that be healthy for me to have that, you know, or really try and really not get rid of it, but just accept it and try and pass it, like it was prevailing no matter where I was on the flip side.
Uh-huh.
And I was just wondering what you thought maybe about that.
It's possible in a situation like that it's genetic, it's just cellular. You know, and you know, the story is just, you know, it, you know, may, you know, it just, you know, many, many, many tens of hundreds of thousands of years of living out there in the wilds has, you know, has not so much conditioned, but selected, I guess, for those people who have fear of cliffs. And we exist today because our, you know, our forebears luckily had lots of fear of cliffs. And I think that's a good example that fear, we don't want to rush to the decision that fear is there because it's unhealthy or it's wrong or it's bad or we need to be brave or, you know, we're kind of, you know, chicken and that's why we're having it. But to allow for that, some of our fears might arise, you know, as almost natural phenomena in a sense. And then it's knowing how to work with that, what to do about that.
Well, surprisingly, you said genetic. Well, one of my other friends, he can walk all around the same cliffside like a spider. It's not worried. I'm more afraid for him than he is for himself.
I've heard several mountain climbers say, usually it's the people who have no fear who die.
Really? Well, I think a certain amount of fear is always healthy, and when people don't have it, it's not necessarily.
Yeah.
It's your body's natural defense to warning you, I think.
Yeah, I think certain situations it's fear. I mean, it's healthy just like that. But what happens for us in our culture is a lot of us spend, you know, an inordinate amount of time being afraid or worried or anxious about things which are not this great imminent danger. You know, and so it's understanding the anxiety, which is pervasive, is really the task of mindfulness. Those kinds of fears there, I think, well, it's also understanding that, but it's not, you don't need to go try to understand the roots of it. You just, oh, I think I better listen to this one. Yeah. I'll be careful as I...
Do you think it would be exaggerated to a degree because of the fact that, as you said Westerners kind of dwell more in it?
I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting, you know, that when I'm driving my car, there are times when I'm a little bit anxious or worried or afraid driving. It has a, you know, and so I drive a little more carefully when it's there. I don't speed as much. But when there's a child in my car with me, I have more fear. And the same exact situation. Or if I think of some of my relatives, the fear has a different qualitative feel or take to it. And so I can imagine someone, you know, someone, for example, is at the edge of a, you know, doing mountain climbing. Two people, right? And they both, or the same person, you know, one year the person is doing it and, you know, and they're afraid and they're just afraid. And the next year or 2 years later, that person is married and has given birth to a child. And back home, there's a little baby, one-year-old. And then the fear is, now the fear is still there, but it takes a whole qualitative different, or quantitative different flavor to it because of the other things going on in a person's life. So, you know, and what is that? Is that also, you know, in ourselves, or is that because of story? To respect it all, you know, and sometimes when people do mindfulness practice, things they think like it, you can ultimately understand everything. I don't know if you can understand, you know. Yeah.
What's bringing the fear up, because it may be a very nice warning system.
Right.
This is not right.
I think you stated very well what I wanted to convey here today, is we want to respect or to take all fears as being a warning system, like you said. But then we have to figure out what it's warning us about. Where is the real sense of threat? What's it really about? And sometimes, you know, it's something external that's really we have to attend to. But sometimes it's something which has gone haywire inside of us. You know, something which is a misunderstood the situation or some kind of inner insecurity that's stimulating it. It has nothing to do with the external world. And addressing the external situation is not really the point. But it's always a warning. It's always I guess I called it a kind of a finger pointing back. It's always an indication that something needs our attention. So we want to respect all our fear. And the way we respect it is to say, well, what does it indicate we have to pay attention to here? So if you're mountain climbing, you better, you know, pay attention to the mountain. But, you know, and if your company's about to move, maybe you need to kind of realistically pay attention to your, you know, your situation, your physical needs, your economic needs, and your needs for friendship, and what you're willing to lose and what you can't lose, and take all that into account. If what you're afraid of is, you know, forgetting your notes tomorrow, and you spend the whole night kind of staying awake, worried you're going to forget your notes to go when you make this presentation, and you study that and you realize really what you're afraid of, you're afraid those people are going to, you know, reject you and think you're a dummy. I don't know if that's, you know, a useful kind of fear to be, you know, to hang out with, but it is an indication that we're preoccupied with how people think about us. And so, what is that about? And then to understand, I notice this is actually a common repeated habit of mine. I'm regularly quite concerned about what people think about me. Concerned enough that I'm really worried and have fear about it. I have fear of going into public places and fear of seeing people and whatever. So rather than kind of take care of the external situation, I need to spend some time trying to understand what this personal fear is about. So I think all fear should be honored and in a sense be taken as a friend. And the task is to figure out what's really going on here.
I think you have a good point that I wanted to go back to when you said that
you said you alluded to the fact that sometimes you have to get past some fear to find out if it's really a fear or an insecurity, or you know what the root of it is. And I think this last year has been one of probably the hardest thing for me to do has been to face myself and face some of those fears that I had never faced before and didn't know what it was about. And just getting past them was, and still is, in some instances, a real struggle. But I appreciate that you see that, because I think a lot of people forget.
So then the last word is, the reason I spend this time talking about fear is that so we pay attention to it more, get to know it better, become friends with it, don't ignore it. It's a big part of our life. So let's end with a short sitting. So thank you all, and I'll see you in a few weeks. Yes?